May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans. I'm a 40156. I'm a public defender, and I'm here today on behalf of Walter Henkins. The only issue in this case was whether Mr. Henkins knew that there were drugs inside of a car that he didn't own and that was shared by at least four people. Now, the jury received two incorrect instructions directly related to that single issue. The first instruction blew up the definition of knowledge to include nothing more than a ground for belief warranting further inspection of the vehicle. And the second told the jury that it could find that definition was met so long as it accepted a single undisputed fact that Mr. Henkins was the sole occupant of the car. I'm happy to answer the court's questions about any aspect of this case this afternoon, but because those two jury instructions were outcome determinative, I plan to focus my attention on them. I'll start with the incorrect definition of knowingly contained in Instruction 13, because I think that the Attorney General and I agree that that definition should not have been presented to the jury. So the only thing that this court needs to decide is whether the error was plain. And what the state was constitutionally required to prove was that Mr. Henkins was actually aware that there were drugs in the car. The statutory definition says that a person acts knowingly with respect to a circumstance when he is aware that such a circumstance exists. And our courts have made clear that if the jury doesn't understand that statutory definition, then it cannot fulfill its constitutional duty to find the elements of the charged crime.
Pardon me for interrupting. Wasn't a proper definition of knowingly also given to the jury?
The proper definition that was included in instruction number 12 was buried by instruction number 13. When you take the two instructions and look at them side by side, which is exactly what the jury would have done, and exactly what this court is required to do, evaluating the jury instructions as a whole. When we look at instruction number 12, which is the standard culpable mens rea instruction which is given, it references knowingly, it references willfully, it references conduct, circumstances, and results of conduct. It does all of this in two sentences at the bottom of that instruction. Instruction 13.
If I may interrupt again, please, but that was a proper statement of the statute, right?
That was a proper statement of the statute, but the problem is that's not what the jury was told to apply, because in the very next instruction, it says very clearly, certain words or phrases have a particular meaning, and right below that, knowingly means reason to know or belief or ground which warrants further belief or inspection. So viewing the instructions as a whole, there's one instruction that talks about mens rea, and then there's one that tells the jury precisely what knowingly means. And we have to assume that the jury would have used that more clear instruction. And Francis Free Franklin tells us that even if we do look at this as a situation where there was one right and one wrong instruction, we can't assume that the jury would have based its verdict on the correct one where the two are materially different. And that incorrect definition,
Are the two materially different? What does the wrong instruction add to the analysis that the right instruction doesn't include?
In Pierce, the Colorado Supreme Court looked at language identical to what was included in Instruction 13 and held that it was materially broader than what's included in the statutory definition, which was listed in Instruction 12. So the short answer is that the Colorado Supreme Court says yes, but I think that just as a matter of a common understanding of the language, ground for belief is broader than actually knowing something. And just by random chance, the way in which it's different and the extra stuff that reason for belief would incorporate played precisely into the evidence that was presented to the jury.
Mr. Evans, but in this case, the prosecution didn't advance a theory that Mr. Henkins should have gone through the contents of the car, that he had some sort of duty to figure out what was in the car before he undertook to drive it. I mean, the prosecution in this case relied on his very own statement that if I knew I had any meth left, I would have smoked it. I mean, he himself, that statement can be construed to mean that he knew.
That statement, well, Your Honor, that statement can be construed a lot of different ways. We don't know exactly what Mr. Henkins said because that statement was related to a police officer 9 months after it was stated. It could have been a joke. It could have been an admission that he used methamphetamine, but either way, that statement does not clearly say, I knew that the drugs that I was charged with possessing were stashed underneath my seat. And indeed, he certainly did not admit to the officer that he owned the bag that was pulled out from underneath the seat of the car that he was driving.
He could have said something to the effect of, well, if I knew my stepdaughter had any of this stuff in here, then I would have never taken the car. I mean, he didn't make a statement to that effect. He's saying, if I knew that I had meth.
He could have said any number of things, but the point is, what the prosecution told the jury that it had to do in closing argument was find that he knew drugs were there. And when the jury looked at the elemental for possession of a controlled substance and said, okay, we need to find knowingly, and then flipped to the definition page that contained the definition of knowingly that said knowingly means, what knowingly meant was reason to believe or grounds to believe, grounds to investigate. And the Colorado Supreme Court has already said that that's closer to a negligent standard. And negligent possession of a controlled substance isn't a crime. So what he said, regardless of how it's interpreted, doesn't determine the outcome of this case. And this is not a case where Mr. Hankins just has thrown up his hands and said, hey, I didn't know the drugs were in there. He presented evidence that was essentially undisputed, providing an alternate explanation for how the drugs got there. And his longtime partner, Ms. Henderson, testified that it was either her daughter or her daughter's friends who were the likely source of the drugs. And that testimony was supported by circumstantial evidence from the arresting officer, who testified that indeed the car was cluttered and that Mr. Hankins exhibited zero signs of being intoxicated by a controlled substance.
Well, pardon me, Mr. Evans, this goes to your first argument, and I understand I may be taking you off track here, and I apologize for doing so, but I'm gonna. This has to do with the impeachment of CH, with the testimony about the domestic violence. I'm concerned that we've got the wrong cabinet here for analyzing it. And I'd like the Attorney General to address this issue too. You say it's not 404B evidence. Okay, I see that. The Attorney General says it's 608B evidence, but I don't think that's so clear because A, it didn't have to do with the witness's bad acts, and B, the witness, as you point out, was not put on for purposes of testifying about his character for truthfulness or untruthfulness. It was about other stuff. So I'd like both of you to address what really is the right analytical cabinet for us to analyze your allegation of error.
Well, I think that the case law indicates that the most important part of the analysis is the 403 analysis, and that comes in whether you start going down a 404B road or whether you start going down a 608 road. Either way, you get to whether it's more unfairly prejudicial than it is probative. And that's the part that, you know, that's the heart of the argument, that ultimately the fact that this stuff happened years distant had absolutely nothing to do with her credibility and only served to make my client look like a bad guy. And I think that in a lot of respects, 608 is probably the way to begin the analysis because it was, it's been a while since I've reviewed this portion of the record, but the prosecutor framed that, indicated that he wanted to bring it in to attack the credibility of the witness. But there's case law that's been cited, I know, in the reply brief, indicating that when the information attacking the credibility of the witness pertains to the acts of the defendant, then elements of the 404B analysis come in as well. So I can feel as I'm standing here that that answer has done nothing but muddy it, but ultimately the answer is 403. That is what I'm hanging my hat on.
Thank you.
The jury in this case received information not just about the stop, but also it heard through the defense witness about Mr. Hankins, about his life and the people who are in his life. And the picture that was shown to the jury was a picture of a group of people who were desperately poor, who had a very unique living situation that had to look kind of strange to the jury, and that at least one member of that group used methamphetamine. And faced with that picture, I think it's very easy to understand how the jury could have looked at the evidence and said, you know, even if we're not sure whether Mr. Hankins actually knew that there are drugs in the car, he probably should have had ground for belief that warrants further inspection.
Mr. Evans, but wasn't part of the defense strategy to present that picture? I mean, the defense was actively presenting evidence that it wasn't just Mr. Hankins that had use of this car.
Right. I'm sure had the defense realized that there was going to be an instruction defining knowingly as reason to believe, that would not have been presented. I don't think any of the attorneys realized that that instruction went to the jury when it went back. I think that this was a legitimate mistake on the part of either the DA or the judge. But certainly that instruction did not shape the theory of defense. Rather than try to skim over the permissive inference instruction, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal unless the court has further questions about the case. Okay.
Please, the court. Good afternoon. My name is John First. I'm here for the people. Judge Bernard, I'll start with your question about about the cabinet. Mostly, I hadn't thought about. I think your point is that since it wasn't the witness's bad act, it was arguably the defendant's bad act, except to the extent that it was, as general and vague as the reference was. Nonetheless, it did refer to defendant. I think it smells more like 608B to me than 404B. If the court were to, it's not clean under either analysis. Mr. Evans is right. The prosecution approached it as if it were 608B evidence. They took they related it solely to credibility of the witness and took the answer, which is what you do under 608B. You take it, you move it on.
If I may,
sure.
There was no 404B analysis up front. There was no limiting instruction that one would have under 404B. And it appears the parties just analyzed it from the perspective of impeachment. Am I right about that?
It seems like everybody was on that page, yes, on the 608 page. Of course, in that respect, the court did offer. Now, had it been 404B, the case law said it's not reversible error not to give a limiting instruction, but clearly, I think, under 404B, the court has a greater obligation to...
And one was not requested, correct?
One was offered.
But
the court offered the instruction, but I'm willing to give it, defense counsel never availed herself of that request. So
why isn't this cabinet 611B? Which is, the basic impeachment of a witness on cross-examination.
Right. It could be. That's kind of as more of a catch-all general.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And then, of course, as Mr. Evans points out, we'd have to look at this under a 403 analysis,
which
right?
We do anyway.
Right.
And 404B is a 401, 403,
right.
404 analysis anyway. We're always there. We're always with relevance. We're always with unfair prejudice that substantially outweighs the probative value here. So
So would you like to address the 403 aspect of that, in that this is a conduct that dates back several years before the crime alleged in this case, and the fact that the witness and the defendant are no longer in relationship seems to make the relevance there rather tenuous, which then makes the prejudice more pronounced. Would you like to address that?
Well, I think the assumption here is that because there are no longer, well, in this relationship that they had shared for 10 years, that there wasn't still, couldn't still be some controlling aspect to it. And I say that for several reasons. First of all, the length of the relationship itself was undisputedly 10 years, intimate, lived together. They had a daughter together. After that relation, that nature of that relationship changed, he was still living in the same apartment with her and her then boyfriend, who was her friend. I mean, this is, convenience and lighting, we don't know. And and he was still, they were still co-parenting, so they were still very much intricate, intertwined involvement with them. And I think it was, based on that, it certainly would have been more probative had they been in that 10-year intimate relationship. We don't know that it wasn't intimate. In the reply brief, defense counsel says that they weren't a romantic relationship, but the citation was to defense counsel's in limine argument, not testimony. I mean, we don't know. I mean, it's a very unusual relationship, enlightened maybe, but nonetheless, still very close. And there still could certainly be some elements of control going to her credibility.
That the prosecution
was entitled to some limited extent to explore. And the court put circumscribed the questioning very closely.
Pardon me for interrupting. I'm sorry, I jumped on your answer. Okay, I understand that theory, but here's for me a concern that I hope you'll address. You have an allegation, well, we're concerned that defendant is controlling witness. All right, fair enough. But the way the prosecution goes about showing that is he was twice, apparently there were twice, charges brought against him for domestic violence. And although I understand that sort of generally there is an idea out there that batterers control their victims, and I'm not saying that did or did not happen here, there seemed to be no further foundation beyond the fact that we're just going to throw a couple of domestic violence arrests out. And I'm concerned that there was not a clear link between what they sought to impeach her with, he's controlling her, and what would be, if I may be so brash as to suggest, some pretty damning evidence about crimes that have nothing to do with this possession offense.
Well, I mean, first of all, as background, let me say that the only evidence was the question. I mean, in terms of details, two domestic violence reports. We don't know if there was an arrest. That I think makes them assume there was no evidence there was any conviction, anything like that. We don't know the nature of the basis for the factual basis for the complaints. So that seems to me to, I don't want to use the word minimize, but reduce the potential. For any prejudice. What would the court have had required? I suppose the trial court in limine could have questioned the prosecution on the nature of the complaints to see if the more serious the domestic violence, the underlying, that maybe the more likely that it would have been controlling. Is that what the court's getting?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is this appears to me to be a fairly cursory description of what happened and a few questions based upon it. It was basically, okay, there were two domestic violence reports, and don't you think he was controlling you? No. That was it. As I read the exchange, that was basically it. And based on that, where is... I'm really concerned that you've got this bomb, i.e. he's a batterer, that gets thrown into this case, and there's no real basis for connecting that bomb with her unwillingness to testify, or her willingness to testify for him. I'm sorry.
Yeah. When you call it a bomb, and defense calls it, essentially a bomb, in effect, but that requires the jury to speculate. And that's not, they're told that, reasonable doubt is a doubt based on, reason and common sense arising from a fair and rational reading of the evidence. It's not fair and rational to speculate without any of the detail as to that. It was limited, the prosecution limited that evidence to her credibility. Didn't make a big deal out of it. She said, no, I'm not being controlled. No, I'm not afraid. Defense counsel elicited that. So, if the jury had heard the details, I think this would be a different case. And they didn't. Your question kind of is a two-edged sword, certainly, because... that's what the fact that they didn't, and that the court kept very tight rein on the evidence that came in, I think, made the balance, Judge Netto, kept any prejudice, unfair prejudice, from substantially outweighing.
Okay, I'm sorry to take you off track from the instruction issue, and I'll stop harassing you now.
Counsel, I would like for you to tell us a framework in your mind how we can look at these two knowingly instructions and read them somehow together so that the jury was properly instructed. The second one is so clearly wrong.
No question.
If we have to look at them as a whole, how can we read the two together? How can you suggest we read the two together in a way that would make that error not reversible?
Not plain. Well, I my brief hinted at it, but argument's a good thing. Sometimes it helps to clarify the thinking. And in my brief, I was getting at it, but I think not as clearly as I could have. And what I said in my brief paraphrase is that the second definition, having general knowledge of a reason to know, or a belief, or a ground for belief, which warrants further inspection or inquiry, or both, colon. And what I argued in my brief is that the descriptor after the colon of the character and content of any material described herein related only to the ground for belief, but it's clear when you read the instruction that every aspect of knowingness, knowledge, in this additional instruction is meant to go to the character and content of any material described herein. And that doesn't go, the issue in this, and so to finish that, character and content of any material described, what's the material described? It's the meth. There's no, counsel gave up an opening statement that conceded that this stuff was meth. There was no issue. There was never an issue. Defendant himself, Judge Fox, as you said, if I knew I had any meth left, I would have smoked it. That's why it's somewhat, I don't think it's as ambiguous as defense leads to believe. If I had any left, I would have smoked it. I think that's a pretty clear statement of admission that he knew he had meth. So with defense counsel's concession, and with defendant's statement the character and content of any material, that is the meth, was not at issue. So jury looked at that, said, well, they were told, of course, that they're to also instructed to read all the instructions together as a whole, and they had the correct definition of knowingly as to the real issue of this case, which was the possession itself, not of what, but that he possessed. So that's how I think, you know, and I think it's somewhat telling that the defense counsel didn't object. Now, you know, I've been in trial, and in the heat of instructions, things happen. I mean, at that stage of trial, I'm thinking about my closing argument. And unfortunately, this is where mistakes happen, and it could arguably have been what the defense counsel was thinking. If defense counsel saw it, maybe he read it the same way. I don't know. As I'm suggesting that it, you know, it really did nothing more than address whether he knew it was meth, and they knew that that wasn't an issue. As to Pierce, I mean, it doesn't. Pierce is dictum. It's, and in terms of reading it broader, I mean, it's not what it was talking about. Reading the Denver ordinance that was at issue at Pierce more broadly than the state that this statute that they took the definition from. So clearly says nothing for this case. And if the court has any other questions, I just ask that you affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate it. Mr. Evans, you got 346.
Your Honor, in regard to the Pierce decision that the Attorney General was just referencing, the reason that the Colorado Supreme Court declared a statute unconstitutional in Pierce was that, and I'm quoting, the ordinance incorporates a definition of required mens rea element which is materially broader than what's contained in the state statute. And it quotes the state statute and language that's identical to what appears in this case. So I don't think that's dicta. I think that that's one of the reasons for the decision. Picking apart the erroneous definition of knowingly in Instruction 13, the Attorney General says that the material described herein that is referenced in that definition has to refer to the meth itself, which assumes knowledge that meth is there, which is what the definition is required, I mean, is in there to ask the jury to find. And I think that the much more logical reason, meaning that the jury would assign to that, is that the material described in herein is referring to the car. I mean, based on the evidence that the jury received, the jury can read this instruction and think, if Mr. Hankins knew that his stepdaughter liked to smoke meth, then he should have inspected the car before he went driving around. That's the way I think a reasonable juror would read this definition of knowingly provided, and that's not a crime. I mean, he can't be held criminally liable for that. He has to actually know that there's methamphetamine in the car. Returning to the evidence of domestic violence, I do want to clarify, just in terms of the facts that were presented to the jury, there's no evidence that they were still in a romantic relationship, nor that the relationship was enlightened in any way other than existing for economic necessity. And the jury heard an awful lot about how poor these people were and how they had to steal license plates tags in order to keep the car running. And it's that information. I mean, there's nothing about whether they were in a romantic relationship, and there's no information about when these allegations of domestic violence occurred.
Let me interrupt you for a second, Mr. Evans. Let's assume for purposes of argument the questioning went like this. Ms. C.H., you have lived with a defendant for some time, yes. And he assaulted you a couple times, yes. And in the course of that, you got a restraining order, yes. And you said on the restraining order that you were afraid of him, yes. You testified today for him, yes. is it reasonable to infer that the reason you're here today is because you are afraid of him? I understand that wasn't the testimony, but would that have been permissible, the hypothetical I just gave to you?
I think that it probably would, but the difference between what you're talking about and what happened here is the level of detail about what's provided to the jury. And the Attorney General would have us believe that because the jury didn't receive a lot of detail about what actually occurred, that they would disregard that and not consider it severe. But I think that just the opposite is true. Because all they heard were the words domestic violence, they were left to their imagination to try to come up with what exactly that meant. And can I finish my thought?
Please finish your answer.
And that leaves the jury to incorporate its common experience, like it's instructed to do in the instructions, and just come to the realization that people who are accused of domestic violence are dirtbags. And in this case, where the evidence was so close, I didn't raise a sufficiency argument because my position is that the jury was never asked to find that he committed an actual crime. But in a case where the evidence was so conflicting and the jury received instructions that were so clearly erroneous, the prejudicial impact of that message, that my client was a dirtbag, cannot be overestimated. So I'd ask this court to reverse his conviction for possession of a controlled substance.
Thank you, counsel, very much for your arguments. We appreciate them, and we appreciate your time, not only today, but in preparing for arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.